Hachette Audio presents The Terror, written by Dan Simmons, read by Tom Seld. This book is dedicated with love and many thanks for the indelible Arctic memories to Kenneth Toby, Margaret Sheridan, Robert Cornthwaite, Douglas Spencer, Dewey Martin, William Self, George Fenneman, Dmitry Tiomkin, Charles Lederer, Christian Nyby, Howard Hawks, and James Arness. This elusive quality it is which causes the thought of whiteness when divorced from more kindly associations and coupled with any object terrible in itself to heighten that terror to the furthest bounds. Witness the white bear of the poles and the white shark of the tropics. What but their smooth, flaky whiteness makes them the transcendent horrors they are? That ghastly whiteness it is which imparts such an abhorrent mildness, even more loathsome than terrific, to the dumb gloating of their aspect, so that not the fierce-fanged tiger in his heraldic coat can so stagger courage as the white-shrouded bear or shark. Herman Melville, Moby Dick, 1851. Chapter 1. Crozier. Latitude, 70 degrees, 5 minutes north. Longitude, 98 degrees, 23 minutes west. October, 1847. Captain Crozier comes up on deck to find his ship under attack by celestial ghosts. Above him, above Terror, shimmering folds of light lunge, but then quickly withdraw like the colourful arms of aggressive, but ultimately uncertain spectres. Ectoplasmic skeletal fingers extend toward the ship, open, prepare to grasp, and pull back. The temperature is minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit and dropping fast. Because of the fog that came through earlier, during the single hours of weak twilight now passing for their day, the four shortened masts, the three topmasts, topgallants, upper rigging and highest spars have been removed and stored to cut down on the danger of falling ice and to reduce the chances of the ship capsizing because of the weight of ice on them, stand now like rudely pruned and topless trees, reflecting the aurora that dances from one dimly seen horizon to the other. As Crozier watches, the jagged ice fields around the ship turn blue, then bleed violet, then glow as green as the hills of his childhood in Northern Ireland. Almost a mile off the starboard bow, the gigantic floating ice mountain that hides Terror's sister ship Erebus from view seems for a brief, false moment to radiate colour from within, glowing from its own cold internal fires. Pulling up his collar and tilting his head back out of 40 years' habit of checking the status of masts and rigging, Crozier notices that the stars overhead burn cold and steady, but those near the horizon not only flicker, but shift when stared at, moving in short spurts to the left, then to the right, then jiggling up and down. Crozier has seen this before, in the far south with Ross as well as in these waters on earlier expeditions. A scientist on that South Polar trip, a man who spent the first winter in the ice there grinding and polishing lenses for his own telescope, had told Crozier that the perturbation of the stars was probably due to rapidly shifting refraction in the cold air lying heavy but uneasy over the ice-covered seas and unseen frozen landmasses. In other words, over new continents never before seen by the eyes of man. Or at least, Crozier thinks, in this northern Arctic, by the eyes of white men. Crozier and his friend and then commander James Ross had found just such a previously undiscovered continent, Antarctica, less than 5 years earlier. They named the sea, inlets and landmass after Ross. They named mountains after their sponsors and friends. They named the two volcanoes they could see on the horizon after their two ships, these same two ships, calling the smoking mountains Erebus and Terror. Crozier was surprised they hadn't named some major piece of geography after the ship's cat. They named nothing after him. There is, on this October winter's dark day evening in 1847, no Arctic or Antarctic continent, island, bay, inlet, range of mountains, ice shelf, volcano, or fucking Floberg, which bears the name of Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier. Crozier doesn't give the slightest goddamn. Even as he thinks this, he realizes that he's a little bit drunk. Well, he thinks, automatically adjusting his balance to the icy deck now canted 12 degrees to starboard and down 8 degrees by the bow. I've been drunk more often than not now for 3 years, haven't I? Drunk ever since Sophia. But I'm still a better sailor and captain drunk than that poor unlucky bastard Franklin ever was sober. Or his rosy-cheeked lisping pet poodle Fitzjames, for that matter. Crozier shakes his head and walks down the icy deck forward to the bow and toward the only man on watch he can make out in the flickering light from the Aurora. It is short, rat-faced Cornelius Hickey, Kulka's mate. The men look all the same out here on watch in the dark, since they're all issued the same cold-weather slops, layers of flannel and wool, covered with a heavy waterproof greatcoat, bulbous mittens protruding from voluminous sleeves, their Welsh wigs, heavy watch caps with floppy ears, pulled tight, often with long comforters, scarves, wrapped around their heads, until only the tips of their frostbitten noses are visible. But each man layers or wears his cold weather slops slightly differently, adding a comforter from home, perhaps, or an extra Welsh wig tugged down over the first, or perhaps colourful gloves, lovingly knit by a mother or wife or sweetheart, peeking out from underneath the Royal Navy outer mittens. And Crozier has learned to tell all 59 of his surviving officers and men apart, even at a distance outside and in the dark. Hickey is staring fixedly out beyond the icicle-sheathed bowsprit, the foremost 10 feet of which are now embedded in a ridge of sea ice, as HMS Terror's stern has been forced up by the ice pressure and the bow is pushed lower. Hickey is so lost in thought, or cold, that the Kulka's mate doesn't notice his captain's approach until Crozier joins him at the railing that has become an altar of ice and snow. The lookout's shotgun is propped against that altar. No man wants to touch metal out here in the cold, not even through mittens. Hickey starts slightly as Crozier leans close to him at the railing. Terror's captain can't see the 26-year-old's face, but a puff of his breath, instantly turning into a cloud of ice crystals, reflecting the aurora, appears beneath the thick circle of the smaller man's multiple comforters and Welsh wig. Men traditionally don't salute during the winter in the ice. Not even the casual knuckling of the forehead an officer receives at sea, but the thick-clad Hickey does that odd little shuffle and shrug and head dip, by which the men acknowledge their captain's presence while outside. Because of the cold, the watches have been cut down from 4 hours to 2. God knows, thinks Crozier, we have enough men for that on this overcrowded ship, even with the lookouts doubled, and he can tell just by Hickey's slow movements that he's half frozen. As many times as he's told the lookouts that they have to keep moving on deck, walk, run in place, jump up and down if they have to, all the while keeping their attention on the ice, they still tend to stand immobile for the majority of their watch, just as if they were in the South Seas wearing their tropical cotton and watching for mermaids.
Captain?
Mr. Hickey? Anything?
Nothing since them shots. That one shot, almost 2 hours ago, sir. Just a while ago I heard, maybe a scream? Something, Captain, from out beyond the ice mountain. I reported it to Lieutenant Irving, but he said it was probably just the ice, acting up.
Crozier had been told about the sound of the shot from the direction of Erebus, and had quickly come up on deck 2 hours ago, but there'd been no repetition of the sound, and he'd sent no messenger to the other ship, nor anyone out on the ice to investigate. To go out on the frozen sea in the dark now with that thing waiting in the jumble of pressure ridges and tall sastrugi was certain death. Messages were passed between the ships now only during those dwindling minutes of half-light around noon. In a few days, there would be no real day at all, only Arctic night, round-the-clock night, 100 days of night. Perhaps it was the ice, says Crozier, wondering why Irving hadn't reported the possible scream. The shot as well. Only the ice.
Yes, Captain. The ice it is, sir.
Neither man believes it. A musket shot or shotgun blast has a distinctive sound, even from a mile away, and sound travels almost supernaturally far and clearly this far north. But it's true that the ice pack squeezing ever more tightly against Terror is always rumbling, moaning, cracking, snapping, roaring, or screaming. The screams bother Crozier the most, waking him from his hour or so of sound sleep each night. They sound too much like his mother's crying in her last days. Of that, and his old aunt's tales of banshees wailing in the night, predicting the death of someone in the house, both had kept him awake as a boy. Crozier turns slowly. His eyelashes are already rimmed with ice, and his upper lip is crusted with frozen breath and snot. The men have learned to keep their beards tucked far under their comforters and sweaters, but frequently they must resort to hacking away hair that has frozen to their clothing. Crozier, like most of the officers, continues to shave every morning, although in the effort to conserve coal, the hot water his steward brings him tends to be just barely melted ice, and shaving can be a painful business.
"Is Lady Silence still on deck?" asks Crozier.
"Oh, yes, Captain. She's almost always up here," says Hickey, whispering now as if it made a difference.
Even if Silence could hear them, she couldn't understand their English. But the men believe, more and more every day the thing on the ice stalks them, that the young Eskimo woman is a witch with secret powers.
"She's at the port station with Lieutenant Irving," adds Hickey.
"Lieutenant Irving? His watch should have been over an hour ago."
"Aye, sir. But wherever Lady Silence is these days, there's the lieutenant, sir. If you don't mind me mentioning it, she don't go below, he don't go below. Until he has to, I mean. None of us can stay out here as long as that woman."
"Keep your eyes on the ice and your mind on your job, Mr. Hickey."
Crozier's gruff voice makes the Kulka's mate start again, but he shuffles his shrug salute and turns his white nose back toward the darkness beyond the bow. Crozier strides up the deck, toward the port lookout post. The previous month, he prepared the ship for winter after 3 weeks of false hope of escape in August. Crozier had once again ordered the lower spars to be swung around along the parallel axis of the ship, using them as a ridgepole. Then they had reconstructed the tent pyramid to cover most of the main deck, rebuilding the wooden rafters that had been stowed below during their few weeks of optimism. But even though the men work hours every day, shoveling avenues through the foot or so of snow left for insulation on deck, hacking away ice with picks and chisels, clearing out the spindrift that has come under the canvas roof, and finally putting lines of sand down for traction, there always remains a glaze of ice. Crozier's movement up the tilted and canted deck is sometimes more a graceful half-skating motion than a stride. The appointed port lookout for this watch, Midshipman Tommy Evans, Crozier identifies the youngest man on board by the absurd green stocking cap, obviously made by the boy's mother, that Evans always pulls down over his bulky Welsh wig, has moved 10 paces astern to allow Third Lieutenant Irving and Silence some privacy. This makes Captain Crozier want to kick someone, everyone, in the arse. The Eskimo woman looks like a short, round bear in her furry parka, hood, and pants. She has her back half-turned to the tall lieutenant, but Irving is crowded close to her, along the rail, not quite touching, but closer than an officer and gentleman would stand to a lady at a garden party or on a pleasure yacht.
"Lieutenant Irving."
Crozier didn't mean to put quite so much bark into the greeting, but he's not unhappy when the young man levitates as if poked by the point of a sharp blade, almost loses his balance, grabs the iced railing with his left hand, and, as he insists on doing despite now knowing the proper protocol of a ship in the ice, salutes with his right hand. It's a pathetic salute, thinks Crozier, and not just because the bulky mittens, Welsh wig, and layers of cold weather slops make young Irving look something like a saluting walrus, but also because the lad has let his comforter fall away from his clean-shaven face, perhaps to show Silence how handsome he is. And now two long icicles dangle below his nostrils, making him look even more like a walrus.
"As you were," snaps Crozier. "Goddamn fool," he mentally adds.
Irving stands rigid, glances at Silence, or at least at the back of her hairy hood, and opens his mouth to speak. Evidently, he can think of nothing to say. He closes his mouth. His lips are as white as his frozen skin.
"This isn't your watch, Lieutenant," says Crozier, hearing the whip crack in his voice again.
"Sir, I mean, the captain is correct, sir. I mean...
Irving clamps his mouth shut again, but the effect is ruined somewhat by the chattering of his teeth. In this cold, teeth can shatter after 2 or 3 hours, actually explode, sending shrapnel of bone and enamel flying inside the cavern of one's clenched jaws. Sometimes, Crozier knows from experience, you can hear the enamel cracking just before the teeth explode.
Why are you still out here, John?
Irving tries to blink, but his eyelids are literally frozen open.
You ordered me to watch over our guest, to look out for, to take care of silence, Captain.
Crozier's sigh emerges as ice crystals that hang in the air for a second and then fall to the deck, like so many minuscule diamonds.
I didn't mean every minute, Lieutenant. I told you to watch her. Report to me on what she does, to keep her out of mischief and harm's way on the ship, and to see that none of the men do anything to compromise her. Do you think she's in danger of being compromised out here on deck, Lieutenant?
No, Captain.
Irving's sentence sounds more like a question than an answer.
Do you know how long it takes for exposed flesh to freeze out here, Lieutenant?
No, Captain. I mean, yes, Captain. Rather quickly, sir, I think.
You should know, Lieutenant Irving. You've had frostbite 6 times already, and it's not even officially winter yet.
Lieutenant Irving nods dolefully.
It takes less than a minute for an exposed finger or thumb, or any fleshy appendage, to freeze solid, continues Crozier,
who knows that this is a load of horse cobblers. It takes much longer than that at a mere 50 below. But he hopes that Irving doesn't know this.
After that, the exposed member will snap off like an icicle, adds Crozier.
Yes, Captain.
So do you really think there's any chance that our visitor might be compromised out here on deck, Mr. Irving?
Irving seems to be thinking about this before replying.
It's possible,
Crozier realizes, that the third lieutenant has put far too much thought into this equation already.
Go below, John, says Crozier,
and see Dr. MacDonald about your face and fingers. I swear to God that if you've gotten seriously frostbitten again, I'll dock you a month's Discovery Service pay and write your mother to boot.
Yes, Captain. Thank you, sir.
Irving starts to salute again, thinks better of it, and ducks under the canvas toward the main ladderway with one hand still half raised. He does not look back at silence. Crozier sighs again. He likes John Irving. The lad had volunteered, along with 2 of his mates from the HMS Excellent, Second Lieutenant Hodgson and First Mate Hornby, but the Excellent was a damned 3-decker that was old before Noah had fuzz around his dongle. The ship had been mastless and permanently moored in Portsmouth, Crozier knew, for more than 15 years, serving as a training vessel for the Royal Navy's most promising gunners.
Unfortunately, gentlemen,
Crozier had told the boys during their first day aboard. The captain had been more than usually drunk that day.
If you look around, you'll notice that while Terror and Erebus were both built as bombardment ships, gentlemen, neither has a single gun between them. We are young volunteers from Excellent, unless one counts the Marines' muskets and the shotguns secured in the spirit room as gunless as a newborn babe. As gunless as fucking Adam in his fucking birthday suit. In other words, gentlemen, you gunnery experts are about as useful to this expedition as teats would be on a boar.
Crozier's sarcasm that day hadn't dampened the young gunnery officer's enthusiasm. Irving and the other 2 remained more eager than ever to go get frozen in the ice for several winters. Of course, that had been on a warm May day in England in 1845.
And now the poor young pup is in love with an Eskimo witch,
Crozier mutters aloud. As if understanding his words, silence turns slowly toward him. Usually her face is invisible, down the deep tunnel of her hood, or her features are masked by the wide ruff of wolf hair, but tonight Crozier can see her tiny nose, large eyes, and full mouth. The pulse of the aurora is reflected in those black eyes. She's not attractive to Captain Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier. She has too much of the savage about her to be seen as fully human, much less as physically attractive,
even to a Presbyterian Irishman. And besides that, his mind and lower regions are still filled with clear memories of Sophia Cracroft. But Crozier can see why Irving, far from home and family and any sweetheart of his own, might fall in love with this heathen woman. Her strangeness alone, and perhaps even the grim circumstances of her arrival and the death of her male companion, so strangely intertwined with the first attacks from that monstrous entity out there in the dark, must be like a flame to the fluttering moth of so hopeless a young romantic as Third Lieutenant John Irving. Crozier, on the other hand, as he discovered, both in Van Diemen's Land in 1840 and again for the final time in England in the months before this expedition sailed, is too old for romance, and too Irish, and too common. Right now, he just wishes this young woman would take a walk out onto the dark ice and not return. Crozier remembers the day 4 months earlier when Dr. MacDonald had reported to Franklin and him after examining her. On the same afternoon, the Eskimo man with her had died, choking in his own blood. MacDonald said, in his medical opinion, the Eskimo girl appeared to be between 15 and 20 years old. It was so hard to tell with native peoples. Had experienced menarche, but was, by all indications, Virgo intacta. Also, Dr. MacDonald reported, the reason that the girl had not spoken or made a sound, even after her father or husband had been shot and lay dying, was because she had no tongue. In Dr. MacDonald's opinion, her tongue had not been sliced off, but had been chewed off near its root, either by Silence herself or by someone or something else. Crozier had been astonished, not so much by the fact of the missing tongue, but from hearing that the Eskimo wench was a virgin. He'd spent enough time in the Northern Arctic, especially during Parry's expedition, which wintered near an Eskimo village, to know that the local natives took sexual intercourse so lightly that men would offer their wives and daughters to whalers or Discovery Service explorers in exchange for the cheapest trinket. Sometimes, Crozier knew, the women just offered themselves up for the fun of it, giggling and chatting with other women or children, even as the sailors strained and puffed and moaned between the laughing women's legs. They were like animals. The furs and hairy hides they wore might as well be their own beast-like skins, as far as Francis Crozier was concerned. The captain raises his gloved hand to the bill of his cap, secured under two wraps of heavy comforter, and therefore impossible to doff or tip, and says, "My compliments to you, madam, and I would suggest you consider going below to your quarters soon. It's getting a bit nippy out here." Silence stares at him. She does not blink, although somehow her long lashes are free of ice. She does not, of course, speak. She watches him. Crozier symbolically tips his hat again and continues his tour around the deck, climbing to the ice-raised stern and then down the starboard side, pausing to speak to the other two men on watch, giving Irving time to get below and out of his cold-weather slops, so that the captain doesn't seem to be following hard on his lieutenant's heels. He's finishing his chat with the last shivering lookout, able seaman Shanks, when Private Wilkes, the youngest of the Marines aboard, comes rushing out from under the canvas. Wilkes has thrown on only two loose layers over his uniform, and his teeth begin chattering even before he delivers his message.
"Mr. Thompson's compliments to the captain, sir, and the engineer says that the captain should come down to the hold as quick as you might."
Why, if the boiler has finally broken down, Crozier knows they are all dead.
"Begging the captain's pardon, sir, but Mr. Thompson says that the captain is needed because Seaman Manson is near to mutiny, sir."
Crozier stands up straight. "Mutiny?"
"Near to it were Mr. Thompson's words, sir."
"Speak English, Private Wilkes."
"Manson won't carry no more sacks of coal past the dead room, sir, nor go down in the hold no more. He says he respectfully refuses, Captain. He won't come up, but he's sitting on his arse at the bottom of the man ladder and won't carry no more coal back to the boiler room."
What is this nonsense? Crozier feels the first stirrings of a familiar, dark, Irish anger.
"It's the ghosts, Captain,"
says Marine Private Wilkes through chattering teeth.
"We all hear 'em when we're hauling coal or fetching something from deep stores. It's why the men won't go down there below all up deck no more, unless the officers order 'em to, sir. Something's down there in the hold, in the dark. Something's been scratching and banging from inside the ship, Captain. It ain't just the ice. Manson's sure it's his old mate Walker, him. it, and the other corpses stacked there in the dead room, clawing to get out.
Crozier checks his impulse to reassure the Marine private with facts. Young Wilkes might not find the facts so reassuring. The first simple fact is that the scrabbling noise from the dead room is almost certainly the hundreds or thousands of large black rats feasting on Wilkes's frozen comrades. The Norway rats, as Crozier knows better than the young Marine, are nocturnal, which means that they're active day and night during the long Arctic winter, and the creatures have teeth, which constantly keep growing. This, in turn, means the goddamned vermin have to keep chewing. He has seen them chew through Royal Navy oak barrels, inch-thick tins, and even lead plating. The rats are having no more trouble down there with the frozen remains of Seaman Walker and his five unlucky comrades, including three of Crozier's finest officers, than a man would have chewing on a strip of frigid salted beef. But Crozier doesn't think it's only the rats that Manson and the others are hearing. Rats, as Crozier knows from the sad experience of 13 winters in the ice, tend to eat one's friends quietly and efficiently, except for their frequent screeching as the blood-maddened and ravenous vermin turn on one another. It's something else making the clawing and banging noises down on hold deck. What Crozier decides not to remind Private Wilkes of is the second simple fact. While the lowest deck would normally be cold but safe there beneath the waterline or winter line of frozen sea ice, the pressure from the ice has forced Terra's stern more than a dozen feet higher than it should be. The hull there is still locked in, but only by several hundred heaped tons of jagged sea ice, and the added tons of snow the men have piled alongside to within a few feet of the railings so as to provide more insulation during the winter. Something, Francis Crozier suspects, has dug down through these tons of snow and tunneled through the iron-hard slabs of ice to get at the hull of the ship. Somehow, the thing has sensed which parts of the interior along the hull, such as the water storage tanks, are lined with iron, and has found one of the few hollow outside storage areas, the dead room, that leads directly into the ship. And now it's banging and clawing to get in. Crozier knows that there's only one thing on Earth with that much power, deadly persistence and malevolent intelligence. The monster on the ice is trying to get at them from below. Without saying another word to Marine Private Wilkes, Captain Crozier goes below to sort things out. Chapter 2. Franklin. Latitude 51 degrees 29 minutes north. Longitude 0 degrees, 0 minutes west. London, May, 1845. He was, and always would be, the man who ate his shoes. 4 days before they were to sail, Captain Sir John Franklin contracted the influenza that had been going around, getting it, he was sure, not from one of the common sailors and stevedores loading the ships at London's docks, nor from any of his 134 crew members and officers. They were all healthy as dray horses, but from some sickly sycophant in one of Lady Jane's circles of society friends. The man who ate his shoes. It was traditional for the wives of Arctic heroes to sew a flag to be planted at some point farthest north, or in this case, raised upon the completion of the expedition's transit of the Northwest Passage, and Franklin's wife Jane was finishing her sewing of the silken Union Jack when he came home. Sir John came into the parlour and half collapsed onto the horsehair sofa near where she sat. Later, he did not remember removing his boots, but someone must have, either Jane or one of the servants, for soon he was lying back and half dozing, his head aching, his stomach more unsteady than it had ever been at sea, and his skin burning with fever. Lady Jane was telling him about her busy day, never pausing in her recital. Sir John tried to listen, as the fever carried him off on its uncertain tide. He was the man who ate his shoes, and had been for 23 years, ever since he returned to England in 1822, after his first failed overland expedition across northern Canada to find the Northwest Passage. He remembered the sniggers and jokes upon his return. Franklin had eaten his shoes, and he'd eaten worse on that botched 3-year journey, including tripe de roche,
a disgusting gruel made from lichen scraped from rocks. 2 years out and starving, he and his men, Franklin, had dazedly divided his troop into three groups and left the other two bands to survive or die on their own, had boiled the uppers on their boots and shoes to survive. Sir John, he was just John then, he was knighted for incompetency after a later overland voyage and botched polar expedition by sea, had spent days in 1821 chewing on nothing more than scraps of untanned leather. His men had eaten their buffalo sleeping robes. Then some of them had moved on to other things. But he had never eaten another man. To this day, Franklin doubted whether others on his expedition, including his good friend and chief lieutenant, Dr. John Richardson, had succeeded in resisting that temptation. Too much had happened while the parties were separated as they stumbled through the Arctic wastes and forests, desperately trying to get back to Franklin's little improvised Fort Enterprise and the real forts, Providence and Resolution. 9 white men and 1 Eskimo dead. 9 dead out of the 21 men young Lieutenant John Franklin, 33 years old and pudgy and balding even then, had led out of Fort Resolution in 1819, plus one of the native guides they'd picked up along the way. Franklin had refused to let the man leave the expedition to forage for himself. 2 of the men had been murdered in cold blood. At least one of them was, without doubt, devoured by others. But only one Englishman died. Only one real white man. All the rest were mere French voyageurs or Indians. This was success of a sort. Only one white Englishman dead, even if all the others had been reduced to gibbering, bearded skeletons. Even if all the others survived only because George Back, that confounded, oversexed midshipman, had snowshoed 1,200 miles to bring back supplies, and more important than supplies, more Indians to feed and care for Franklin and his dying party. That confounded Back. Not a good Christian at all. Arrogant. Not a true gentleman, despite his later being knighted for an Arctic expedition sailing on this very same HMS Terror that Sir John now commanded. On that expedition, Back's expedition, Terror had been flung 50 feet into the air by a rising tower of ice, then thrown down so violently that every oak plank in the hull sprang a leak. George Back brought the leaking boat all the way back to the coast of Ireland, beaching it just hours before it would have sunk. The crew had wrapped chains around it to squeeze the boards tight long enough for the vessel to get them home. All the men had scurvy, black gums, bleeding eyes, teeth falling out of their heads, and the madness and delusions that went with scurvy. They'd knighted Back after that, of course. It's what England and the Admiralty did after you returned from a polar expedition that failed miserably, resulting in appalling loss of life. If you survived, they gave you a title and a parade. After Franklin returned from his second coastal mapping expedition in the far north of North America in 1827, he was personally knighted by King George IV. The Geographical Society of Paris gave him a gold medal. He was awarded captaincy of the beautiful little 26-gun frigate HMS Rainbow, and ordered to the Mediterranean, a destination to which every captain in the Royal Navy prayed nightly for posting. He proposed marriage to one of his dead wife Eleanor's dearest friends, the energetic, beautiful and outspoken Jane Griffin.
"So I explained to Sir James over tea," Jane was saying, "that my darling Sir John's credit and reputation are infinitely dearer to me than any selfish enjoyment of my husband's society, even if he must be gone for 4 years or 5.
What was the name of that 15-year-old copper Indian girl that Back was going to fight a duel over at their winter quarters of Fort Enterprise? Green Stockings. That was it. Green Stockings. That girl was evil. Beautiful, yes, but evil. She had no shame. Franklin himself, despite all efforts never to look her way, had seen her slip out of her heathen robes and walk naked across half the length of the cabin one moonlit night. He was 34 years old at the time, but she was the first naked human female he had ever seen, and even now the most beautiful. The dark skin, the breasts already heavy as globed fruit, but also still those of an adolescent, the nipples not yet raised, the areole strange, smooth, dark brown circles. It was an image Sir John had not been able to eradicate from his memory, try and pray as he might, in the quarter of a century since then. The girl had not the classic V of pubic hair that Franklin had later seen on his first wife, Eleanor, glimpsed only once as she prepared for her bath, since Eleanor never allowed the slightest light to illuminate their rare lovemaking, or the sparser but wilder wheat-coloured nest that was part of the aging body of his current wife, Jane. No, the Indian girl green stockings had only a narrow but pure black vertical escutcheon above her female parts, as delicate as a raven's feather, as pitch black as sin itself. The Scotsman midshipman Robert Hood, who had already fathered one bastard with a different Indian woman during that endless first winter at the cabin Franklin had named Fort Enterprise, had promptly fallen in love with teenaged copper squaw Greenstockings. The girl had previously been lying with the other midshipman, George Back, but with Back gone hunting, she'd shifted her sexual allegiance to Hood with the ease known only to pagans and primitives. Franklin could still remember the grunts of passion in the long night. Not the passion of a few minutes, as he had experienced with Eleanor, never grunting or making a noise, of course, since no gentleman would do that, or even two brief bouts of passion, such as on that memorable night on his honeymoon with Jane. No, Hood and Green Stockings went at it half a dozen times. No sooner would Hood's and the girl's noises stop in the adjoining lean-to than they would begin again. Laughter, low giggles, then soft moans, leading again to the louder cries as the brazen girl-woman urged Hood on. Jane Griffin was 36 years old when she married the newly knighted Sir John Franklin on December 5th, 1828. They honeymooned in Paris. Franklin did not especially like the city, nor did he like the French, but their hotel had been luxurious, and the food very good. Franklin had been in a sort of dread that during their travels on the continent, they might run into that Roger fellow, Peter Mark, the one who gained some sort of literary attention by preparing to publish that silly dictionary, or whatever it was, the same man who had once asked for Jane Griffin's hand, only to be rejected, like all the other suitors had been in her younger years. Franklin had since peeked into Jane's diaries from that era. He rationalized his crime by thinking that she wanted him to find and read the many calfskin-bound volumes. Why otherwise would she have left them in such an obvious place? And saw in his beloved's tight, perfect hand the passage she had written on the day Roger had finally married someone else. "The romance of my life is gone." Robert Hood had been making noises with Green Stockings for six endless Arctic nights when his fellow midshipman George Back returned from a hunting party with the Indians. The two men arranged a duel to the death at sunrise, around 10 a.m. the next morning. Franklin had not known what to do. The corpulent lieutenant was unable to exert any discipline over the surly voyageurs or the contemptuous Indians, much less able to control the headstrong Hood or the impulsive Back. Both midshipmen were artists and mapmakers. From that time on, Franklin had never trusted an artist. When the sculptor in Paris did Lady Jane's hands, and the perfumed sodomite here in London had come for almost a month to paint her official oil portrait, Franklin had never left the men alone with her. Back and Hood were meeting at dawn for a duel to the death, and there was nothing John Franklin could do but hide in the cabin and pray that the resulting death or injury would not destroy the last vestige of sanity in his already compromised expedition. His orders had not specified that he should bring food on the 1,200-mile Arctic overland, coastal sea and river trek. Out of his own pocket, he'd provided enough supplies to feed the 16 men for one day. Franklin had assumed the Indians would then hunt for them and feed them adequately, just as the guides carried his bags and paddled his birch-bark canoe. The birch-bark canoes had been a mistake. 23 years after the fact, he was willing to concede that, to himself at least. After just a few days in the ice-clogged waters along the northern coast, reached more than a year and a half after their departure from Fort Resolution, the flimsy vessels had started to come apart. Franklin, his eyes closed, his brow burning, his head throbbing, half listening to the uninterrupted stream of Jane's chatter, remembered the morning when he'd lain in his heavy sleeping bag and squeezed his eyes shut as Back and Hood had stepped off their 15 paces outside the cabin, then turned to fire. The confounded Indians and confounded voyageurs, equally savage in many ways, were treating the duel to the death as entertainment.
green stockings, Franklin remembered, was radiant that morning with an almost erotic glow.
Lying in his bag, his hands over his ears, Franklin still heard the call to pace, the call to turn, the call to aim, the command to fire. Then two clicks, then laughter from the crowd. During the night, the old Scottish seaman calling the pacing, that tough and ungentlemanly John Hepburn, had unloaded charge and balls from the carefully prepared pistols. Deflated by the unceasing laughter of the mob of voyageurs and knee-slapping Indians, Hood and Back had stalked off in opposite directions. Shortly after that, Franklin ordered George Back to return to the forts to purchase more provisions from the Hudson's Bay Company. Back was gone most of the winter.
Franklin had eaten his shoes and had subsisted on lichen scraped from rocks, a slime meal that would make a self-respecting English dog vomit. But he had never partaken of human flesh.
A long year after the forestalled duel, in Richardson's party after Franklin's group had separated from it, that surly, half-mad Iroquois on the expedition, Michel Terrout, shot the midshipman artist and mapmaker Robert Hood in the centre of his forehead. A week before the murder, the Indian had brought back a strong-tasting haunch of meat to the starving party, insisting that it had come from a wolf that had either been gored to death by a caribou or killed by Terrout himself using a deer horn. The Indian's story kept changing. The ravenous party had cooked and eaten the meat, but not before Dr. Richardson noticed a slight hint of a tattoo on the skin. The doctor later told Franklin that he was certain that Terrout had doubled back to the body of one of the voyageurs who had died during that week on the trek. The starving Indian and the dying Hood were alone when Richardson, off scraping lichen from the rocks, had heard the shot.
"Suicide," Terrout had insisted.
But Dr. Richardson, who had attended on more than a few suicides, knew that the position of the ball in Robert Hood's brain had not come from a self-inflicted gunshot. Now the Indian armed himself with a British bayonet, a musket, two fully charged and half-cocked pistols, and a knife as long as his forearm. The two non-Indians remaining, Hepburn and Richardson, had only a small pistol and one untrustworthy musket between them. Richardson, now one of the most respected scientists and surgeons in England, friend of the poet Robert Burns, but then only a promising expedition surgeon and naturalist, waited until Michel Terrout returned from a foraging trip, made sure his arms were full of firewood, and then lifted his pistol and cold-bloodedly shot the Indian through the head. Dr. Richardson later admitted to eating the dead Hood's buffalo robe, but neither Hepburn nor Richardson, the only survivors of their party, ever mentioned what else they might have eaten in the next week of arduous trekking during their return to Fort Enterprise. At Fort Enterprise, Franklin and his party were too weak to stand or walk. Richardson and Hepburn seemed strong in comparison. He might be the man who had eaten his shoes, but John Franklin had never...
"Cook is preparing roast beef tonight, my darling, your favourite. Since she's new, I am certain that the Irishwoman was padding our accounts. Stealing is as natural as drinking to the Irish. I reminded her that you insist that it must be rare enough to bleed at the touch of the carving knife."
Franklin, floating on an ebbing tide of fever, tried to formulate words in response, but the surges of headache, nausea, and heat were too great. He was sweating through his undershirt and still fixed collar.
"Admiral Sir Thomas Martin's wife sent us a delightful card today and a wonderful bouquet of flowers. She's the last to be heard from, but I must say the roses are beautiful in the foyer. Did you see them? Did you have time to chat with Admiral Martin at the reception? Of course, he is not that important, is he? Even as controller of the Navy? Certainly not as distinguished as the First Lord or First Commissioners, much less your Arctic Council friends."
Captain Sir John Franklin had many friends. Everyone liked Captain Sir John Franklin, but no one respected him. For decades, Franklin acknowledged the former fact and avoided the latter, but he now knew it to be true. Everyone liked him, no one respected him. Not after Van Diemen's Land, not after the Tasmanian prison and the botch he had made of that. Eleanor, his first wife, had been dying when he left her to go on his second major expedition. He knew she was dying. She knew she was dying. Her consumption, and the knowledge she would die from it long before her husband would die in battle or on expedition, had been with them like a third party at their wedding ceremony. In the 22 months of their marriage, she had given him a daughter, his only child, young Eleanor. A small, frail woman in body, but almost frightening in spirit and energy, his first wife had told him to go on his second expedition to find the Northwest Passage, this trip by land and sea to follow the North American coastline, even while she was coughing up blood and knowing that the end was near. She said that it would be better for her if he were elsewhere. He believed her, or at least he believed that it would be better for himself. A deeply religious man, John Franklin had prayed that Eleanor would die before his departure date. She hadn't. He left on February 16, 1825, wrote his darling many letters while in transit to Great Slave Lake, posted them in New York City and Albany, and learned of her passing on April 24th at the British Naval Station at Penetanguishene. She had died shortly after his ship left England. When he returned from this expedition in 1827, Eleanor's friend Jane Griffin was waiting for him. The Admiralty reception had been less than a week ago. No, just precisely a week ago, before this confounded influenza. Captain Sir John Franklin and all his officers and mates from Erebus and Terror had attended, of course. So had the civilians on the expedition, Erebus's ice master James Reed and Terror's ice master Thomas Blanky, along with the paymasters, surgeons and pursers. Sir John had looked dashing in his new blue swallow-tailed coat, blue gold-striped trousers, gold-fringed epaulettes, ceremonial sword, and Nelson-era cocked hat. The commander of his flagship Erebus, James Fitzjames, often called the handsomest man in the Royal Navy, looked as striking and humble as the war hero he was. Fitzjames had charmed everyone that night. Francis Crozier, as always, had looked stiff, awkward, melancholic, and slightly inebriated. But Jane was wrong. The members of the Arctic Council were not Sir John's friends. The Arctic Council, in reality, did not exist. It was an honorary society rather than a real institution, but it was also the most select old boys' club in all of England. They'd mingled at the reception, Franklin, his top officers, and the tall, gaunt, grey members of the legendary Arctic Council. To gain membership to the council, all one had to do was command an expedition to the farthest Arctic North and survive. Viscount Melville, the first notable in the long receiving line that had left Franklin uncharacteristically sweating and tongue-tied, was first Lord of the Admiralty and the sponsor of their sponsor, Sir John Barrow. But Melville was not an old Arctic hand. The true Arctic Council legends, most in their 70s, were to the nervous Franklin that night more like the coven of witches in Macbeth, or like some cluster of grey ghosts than like living men. Every one of these men had preceded Franklin in searching for the passage, and all had returned alive, yet not fully alive. Did anyone, Franklin wondered that evening, really return alive after wintering in the Arctic regions? Sir John Ross, his Scotsman's face showing more sharp facets than an iceberg, had eyebrows leaping out like the ruffs and feathers of those penguins his nephew Sir James Clark Ross had described after his trip to the South Arctic. Ross's voice was as rough as a holy stone dragged across a splintered deck. Sir John Barrow, older than God and twice as powerful, the father of serious British Arctic exploration. All others there that night, even the white-haired septuagenarians, were boys, Barrow's boys. Sir William Parry, a gentleman above gentlemen even when among royalty, who had tried four times to force the passage, only to watch men die, and his fury squeezed and smashed and sunk. Sir James Clark Ross, newly knighted, was also newly wed to a wife who made him swear off any more expeditions. He would have had Franklin's job of commander of this expedition if he'd wanted it, and both men knew it. Ross and Crozier stood slightly separate from the others,
drinking and talking as softly as conspirators. That confounded Sir George Back. Franklin hated sharing serdom with a mere midshipman who once served under him, and a womanizer at that. On this gala night, Captain Sir John Franklin almost wished that Hepburn hadn't taken the powder and shot out of the dueling pistols 25 years earlier. Back was the youngest member of the Arctic Council, and seemed happier and smugger than any of the others, even after suffering the battering and near sinking of HMS Terror. Captain Sir John Franklin was a teetotaler, but after 3 hours of champagne, wine, brandy, sherry, and whiskey, the other men began to relax. The laughter around him grew stronger, and the conversation in the Grand Hall less formal, and Franklin began to feel calmer, realizing that all this reception, all the gold buttons, silk cravats, gleaming epaulettes, fine food, cigars, and smiles were for him. This time, it was all about him. So it was a shock when the older Ross pulled him aside almost abruptly and began to bark questions at him through the cigar smoke and the glint of candlelight off crystal.
"Franklin, why in hell's name are you taking 134 men?"
rasped the Holystone across rough wood. Captain Sir John Franklin blinked.
"It's a major expedition, Sir John. Too bloody major, if you ask me. It's hard enough to get 30 men across the ice into boats and back to civilization when something goes wrong. 134 men."
The old explorer made a rude noise, clearing his throat as if he was going to spit. Franklin smiled and nodded, wishing the old man would leave him alone.
"And your age," continued Ross. "You're 60, for God's sake."
59, Franklin said stiffly. "Sir?"
The elder Ross smiled thinly, but looked more like an iceberg than ever.
"Terror is what? 330 tons? Erebus something like 370.
372 for my flagship," said Franklin. 326 for Terror.
"And a draft of 19 feet each, isn't that right?"
Yes, my lord."
"That's buggering insane, Franklin. Your ships will be the deepest draft vessels ever sent on an Arctic expedition. Everything we know about those regions has shown us that the waters where you're headed are shallow, filled with shoals, rocks, and hidden ice. My Victory only drew a fathom and a half, and we couldn't get over the bar of the harbour where we wintered. George Back all but ripped his bottom out on the ice with your Terror."
"Both ships have been strengthened, Sir John," said Franklin.
He could feel sweat running down his ribs and chest onto his portly belly.
"They're now the strongest ice ships in the world."
"And what is all the nonsense about steam and locomotive engines?"
"Not nonsense, my lord,"
said Franklin, and could hear the condescension in his own voice. He knew nothing about steam himself, but he had two good engineers on the expedition, and Fitz James, who was part of the new steam navy.
"These are powerful engines, Sir John. They'll see us through the ice where sail has failed."
Sir John Ross snorted. "Your steam engines aren't even maritime engines, are they, Franklin?"
"No, Sir John. But they're the best steam engines the London and Greenwich Railway could sell us. Converted for marine use. Powerful beasts, sir."
Ross sipped his whiskey. "Powerful if you're planning to lay down rails across the Northwest Passage and take a goddamned locomotive across it." Franklin chuckled good-naturedly at this, but he saw no humour in the comment, and the obscenity offended him deeply. He often could not tell when others were being humorous, and he had no sense of humour himself.
"But not really so powerful," continued Ross. "That 1.5-ton machine they crammed into the hold of your Erebus only produces 25 horsepower.
Crozier's engine is less efficient, 20 horsepower maximum. The ship that's towing you beyond Scotland, Rattler, produces 220 horsepower with its smaller steam engine. It's a marine engine, built for sea."
Franklin had nothing to say to that, so he smiled. To fill the silence, he signalled a passing waiter carrying glasses of champagne,
Then, since it was against all his principles to drink alcohol, all he could do was stand there holding the glass, occasionally glancing at the flattening champagne and wait for some opportunity to get rid of it without being noticed.
Think of all the extra provisions you could have crammed in the holds of your two ships if those damned engines weren't there, persisted Ross.
Franklin looked around, as if seeking rescue, but everyone was in animated conversation with someone else.
We have more than adequate stores for 3 years, Sir John, he said at last. 5 to 7 years if we have to go on short rations.
He smiled again, trying to charm that flinty face.
And both Erebus and Terra have central heating, Sir John. Something I'm sure you would have appreciated on your victory.
Sir John Ross's pale eyes gleamed coldly.
Victory was crushed like an egg by the ice, Franklin.
Fancy steam heat wouldn't have helped that, would it? Franklin looked around, trying to catch Fitzjames's eye. Even Crozier's. Anyone to come to his rescue. No one seemed to notice the old Sir John and the fat Sir John huddled there in such earnest, if one-sided, conversation. A waiter passed, and Franklin set his untouched glass of champagne on his tray. Ross studied Franklin through slitted eyes.
And how much coal does it take just to heat one of your ships for a day up there?
Pressed the old Scotsman.
Oh, I don't really know, Sir John,
said Franklin with a winning smile. He really did not know,
nor especially care.
The engineers were in charge of the steam engines and coal. The Admiralty would have planned well for them.
I know, said Ross. You'll use up to 150 pounds of coal a day just to keep the hot water moving to heat the crew's quarters. Half a ton of your precious coal a day just to keep steam up. If you're underway, expect about 4 knots out of those ugly bombardment ships. You'll be burning 2 to 3 tons of coal a day. Much more if you're trying to force your way through pack ice. How much coal are you carrying, Franklin?
Captain Sir John waved his hand in what he realized was a dismissive and almost effeminate gesture.
Oh, somewhere around 200 tons, my lord.
Ross squinted again.
90 tons each for Erebus and Terran, to be precise, he rasped. And that's when you're topped off in Greenland before you cross Baffin Bay, much less get into the real ice.
Franklin smiled and said nothing.
Say you arrive at where you winter in the ice with 75% of your 90 tons unburned, continued Ross, boring ahead like a ship through soft ice.
That leaves you what? How many days steam under normal conditions, not ice conditions? 12 days? 13 days? A fortnight?
Captain Sir John Franklin had not the slightest idea. His mind, although professional and nautical, simply did not work that way. Perhaps his eyes revealed his sudden panic, not over coal, but over appearing an idiot in front of Sir John Ross, for the old mariner clamped a steel vice grip on Franklin's shoulder. When Ross leaned closer, Captain Sir John Franklin could smell the whiskey on his breath.
What are the Admiralty's plans for your rescue, Franklin? Rasped Ross.
His voice was low. All about them was the laughter and chatter of the reception in its late hour.
Rescue?
Franklin said, blinking. The idea that the two most modern ships in the world, reinforced for ice, powered by steam, provisioned for 5 years or more in the ice, and manned by crews hand-picked by Sir John Barrow, would or could require rescue, simply did not register in Franklin's brain. The idea was absurd.
Do you have plans to cache depots along your way in through the islands? Whispered Ross.
Caches? Said Franklin. Leave our provisions along the way? Why on earth would I do that?
So you can get your men and boats to food and shelter if you have to take to the ice and walk out,
Ross said fiercely, eyes gleaming.
Why would we walk back toward Baffin Bay? Asked Franklin.
Our objective is to complete the transit of the Northwest Passage.
Sir John Ross had pulled his head back, His grip tightened on Franklin's upper arm.
Then there's no rescue ship or plan in place.
No.
Ross grabbed Franklin's other arm and squeezed so tightly that the portly captain, Sir John, almost winced.
Then, laddie, whispered Ross, if we've not heard from ye by 1848, I'll come looking for ye myself. I swear it.
Franklin slammed awake. He was soaked with sweat. He felt dizzy and weak. His heart was pounding, and with each reverberation his headache tolled like a church bell against the inside of his skull. He looked down at himself in horror. Silk covered the lower half of his body.
What is this? He cried in alarm. What is this? There's a flag thrown over me.
Lady Jane stood aghast.
You looked cold, John. You were shivering. I put it over you as a blanket.
My God, cried Captain Sir John Franklin. My God, woman, do you know what you've done? Don't you know they lay the Union Jack over a corpse?